Welcome to On DoD, sponsored by Hewlett-Packard Enterprise on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com. Now, here's your host, Jared Serbu.
And thanks for listening this week. Several topics on our plate during this week's show. Later in the program, we'll talk to the commander of one of the biggest DoD cybersecurity organizations that most people haven't heard of. DISA, Global Operations Command, just cut the ribbon on the largest cyber defense watch floor the Defense Department has ever built. That's at Scott Air Force Base in Illinois, near St. Louis. Colonel Paul Kraft, the commander of DISA Global, will join us on the phone from there. We'll also get into some cutting-edge technology the Army's been working on for nearly a decade to fight the leading killers of U.S. service members on the battlefield. Sensors medics already have, plus a mobile app, lets them find hidden internal bleeding in about 80% of cases. First, though, this is one of the shortest work years in recent memory on Capitol Hill. What's usually the August recess is 7 weeks long this time around. Lawmakers will be back in town for a few more weeks, then back off for election time, and it's still unclear whether they'll come back for a lame duck session in December. As far as defense goes, the shortened work year leaves a lot of work to get done. Besides passing a budget and avoiding sequestration, there's the Defense Authorization Bill, which includes several items that are billed as reforms to the landmark 1986 Goldwater-Nichols Act. To talk about that, we're joined by Justin Johnson, a senior policy analyst at the Heritage Foundation. In a recent commentary, he argued Congress needs to pump the brakes on defense reform, mainly because it's still not clear exactly what problem the reformers are trying to solve. So, Justin, before we talk about the substance of the NDAAs this year and kind of the differences between 1986 and now, which I do want to do, what's your going in position or observations, if you have any, on just sort of whether Goldwater-Nichols needs some revisiting in some form or fashion? You know, putting aside the process the Senate has gone through, are they right to think that it's time to at least reopen the debate?
You know, I think it's the right thing that Congress should be asking. Sorry, it's the right question that Congress should be asking. Because part of their job is to do oversight over the Department of Defense, the federal government writ large. So it's only natural and right that they should be asking this question. And I think there are a lot of indicators out there that, our military, our sort of foreign policy, national security apparatus needs some attention in terms of how it works and what it does. But I think the challenge is really diving in, taking a granular look, and figuring out what specifically needs to change, how we can improve this. Because we're dealing with pretty weighty matters here. If you make a mistake, if you break things, there can be, frankly, deadly consequences.
Yeah, and the report that you wrote for Heritage a few weeks ago does a nice job of contrasting the environment around the debate around the defense reforms that happened in the 1980s compared to today. So maybe you can lay that out for us a little bit, particularly around, as you say, defining the problem first.
Sure. Yeah. So in the 1980s, I think there was a confluence of events that really you had Congress, a number of leading members of Congress, Republican, Democrat, House, Senate, who were all interested in trying to help the Department of Defense do things better. At the same time, you had a series of leaders inside the Pentagon who were also committed to that priority, and they had specific failures that they were dealing with. For example, one is the failure to rescue hostages in Iran. This Desert One incident it revealed a lack of kind of operational coordination between the different services that were involved. A few years later, you had the attempt to basically remove U.S. citizens from Grenada. Where, again, similar kind of operational problems basically all pointed to a common problem of the different military services, the Army, Navy, Air Force, Marine Corps, not being able to work with each other in the field very effectively. And that was really the driving issue that led to Goldwater-Nichols. So Congress and the Pentagon had a clear problem they were trying to solve, and so they could clearly over time think through what possible solutions could be put on the table for that.
And how do you see that as different from what's happening in the current era?
Well, so I think currently, I think it's good that Congress is thinking about these issues and frankly is pushing the Pentagon to think more seriously about these issues. The problem is, I think we're still in the problem definition phase. So there are a lot of folks who've testified to Congress, members of Congress who have opinions on this, and they all seem to sort of have an intuition that there are problems, and they can, but they can't really point to or define a clear underlying issue that they're trying to solve. So they're trying to make things better, which is something that should be applauded. But you need to be very clear about what the problem is that you're trying to solve so that you can thoughtfully consider what solutions are available to fix that problem.
I think Senator McCain, the chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, would quibble with the notion that they haven't come up with a problem definition. He thinks he's defined it fairly clearly. As he puts it, it's strategic integration are the two words he uses. So, you know, the ability to focus resources on a mission across various regions or across various warfighting domains, or, you know, so that you know, you can tackle a problem like ISIS or Russia that spans across multiple COCOMs. So that's where you get the ideas of cross-functional teams, mandating those in law, and then this sort of pilot project to reorganize one of the COCOMs around warfighting missions. Why is his formulation of strategic integration not sufficient as a problem statement in your view?
Well, I think Senator McCain is right in that he is, I think he's rightly assessing the threats that we face. So we are facing these sort of trans-regional, trans-domain threats or multi-domain threats that can move from one combatant command to another or across jurisdictions between State Department and the Department of Defense, for example. So I think the threat he is identifying, I think, is correct. But I think just, you know, the lack of strategic integration, that is sounds good, but when you actually try to peel the layers back a little bit, I'm not sure that there's a real clarity on what that means. So maybe, you know, maybe it is a, is that a DOD problem? Is that a, you know, larger whole of government problem? Is it a integration between DOD and the State Department? Is it really a regional problem? I think just as you try to unpack that, there are a variety of different directions you can go with just trying to figure out what he means by that phrase. So again, I applaud the effort, but I think because of the consequences of or potential unintended consequences of doing things wrong, I think we need to be careful here and make sure that we actually have a clearer definition of what he's trying to do. DOD already can do a lot of the things that Senator McCain is mandating or wants to mandate through the NDAA. So yeah, I'm not sure that so in this case, the potential solution may be, you know, unnecessary, which points back to let's make sure we have a clear idea of what the problem is.
And to paraphrase your paper a little bit, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but what you seem to be getting at is that if there is a lack of strategic integration, there's no clear evidence that that's actually caused an actual military failure or a major military problem.
Yeah, I think that's fair. And obviously with these things, it's always better to avoid a failure by fixing the system in advance. But to do that well, I think you have to have a super clear definition or a real, you know, hard-nosed conversation amongst all the stakeholders involved about what's working and what's not. I think that Senator McCain should be applauded for starting this process. I just think that we need to be careful not to rush too quickly to a particular solution. I also think there's a potential other piece of what's going on that may be informing Senator McCain, which is that, you know, it may not be a system problem that is producing what he calls this lack of strategic integration. It may just be bad decision makers, or from his perspective, bad decision makers, people in positions of authority in the government making decisions that Senator McCain doesn't agree with. He may be seeing that as a lack of strategic integration, but that you know, decision maker problem from Senator McCain's perspective is not something you can fix by legislating.
Absent legislation, are there things that Congress can do in the oversight realm to avoid bad decisions on the part of the bureaucracy?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the first step is Congress. It's as an entity needs to step up its oversight. It's basically its role in these discussions. So I think Senator McCain and Congressman Thornberry from the House are doing the right thing to put these issues on the table, but at an even bigger level above them, at higher levels in Congress, they need to spend more time making sure that all of their members are educated on these issues. They need to be more aggressive in kind of asserting, or before things happen, good or bad, Congress should be considering the issues, laying out positions, discussing pros and cons of different issues, and I think in general, just making sure that Congress has a voice in these discussions. Part of that, one of the things that both Senator McCain and Congressman Thornberry have considered is, you know, creating a panel or some sort of outside experts that work for Congress to help them consider some of these issues. I think all of those efforts to strengthen Congress on this are good and important, and will frankly, over the long term, help produce better reform results for the Pentagon.
That's Justin Johnson. He's a senior policy analyst at the Heritage Foundation. We'll come back and talk more about this year's deliberations on the defense authorization bill after a short break. This is On DoD on federalnewsradio.com, 1500 AM in the Washington area and worldwide on the American Forces Network. I'm Jared Serbin. Back on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM, this is On DoD. I'm Jared Serbu. Justin Johnson is back with us for a few more minutes. He's a senior analyst in defense budgeting policy at the Heritage Foundation. We're talking about this year's deliberations on the defense authorization bill. Those are happening right now between House and Senate staffs on the Armed Services Committees while lawmakers are out of town. And as we've been discussing, a good chunk of the Senate bill deals with reorganization of the Defense Department, billed as a reform to the 1986 Goldwater-Nichols Act. One thing that has struck me about sort of the legislative process that's led up to particularly the Senate bill and how it's different from Goldwater-Nichols is that my recollection from looking at this a few years ago is that Goldwater-Nichols was really the culmination of like 4 years of extensive study and testimony and fairly public debate, as opposed to this bill, which just kind of got dropped as an embargoed mark by the chairman, was debated behind closed doors in the Senate Armed Services Committee, and then suddenly, bam, you have reform legislation. Is that a fair observation, or am I missing some of the public parts of this?
No. So the one piece that you didn't mention is Senator McCain did do a series of hearings last fall.
That's fair,
kind of
yeah.
On Goldwater-Nichols. But I think overall your thesis I would support. Senator McCain, this process, at the kind of the largest you could say we're at, 9 or 10 months, whereas Goldwater-Nichols in the '80s was four and a half years. You had hundreds of pages of committee reports that were publicly available and that were debated. You also, I think perhaps interestingly, the final bill in 1986 was actually a separate standalone piece of legislation separate from the defense authorization bill. So it was kind of considered on its own merits. You had Congress, the House, and the Senate debating that bill alone, without kind of some of the distractions, if you will, that are always come with a defense authorization bill. So I think overall, the process was much longer. That doesn't necessarily mean more thoughtful, but I think it was also more thoughtful in the 1980s and ultimately produced something that has served the military well for the last 30 years.
One thing that's similar, I think, is that both in 1986 and now you have a lot of opposition from the Pentagon to the reform effort. Senator McCain probably sees that as kind of a badge of honor or an endorsement of his bill. Is there, in your view, a productive role for the Pentagon in whatever reforms come up this time around? Or is it just always going to be the case that no bureaucracy is going to want to reform itself and they're going to have to be dragged kicking and screaming?
Yeah, no, I definitely think that there is a better way, or perhaps an ideal way of doing this, where you do have kind of buy-in and support from the Pentagon, at least at certain levels. I think some level of pushback is inevitable. As you said, anytime you're changing a bureaucracy, there's going to be parts of that bureaucracy that resist. But I think part of the difference between now and the 80s, though, is yes, there was opposition to Goldwater-Nichols, but there were also key senior leaders in the Pentagon who were fully supportive of the effort. And frankly, it was senior military leaders who started the public process by asking Congress to help them reform their organization. So I think this time around, what we've seen from the Pentagon is basically reactionary to Senator McCain. You have Secretary Carter, directing a report or directing his team to essentially do a deep dive, but that deep dive was, I think, 30 or 60 days long, to come up with some things for possible Goldwater-Nichols reform. That's not necessarily the same as what we saw in the 80s, where it was really driven by a desire, perhaps an imperative of at least some senior military leaders inside the Pentagon to say, we have to do better. I think today you see military leaders saying, well, Congress wants us to do it, or maybe Secretary Carter wants us to do it, but we also have our hands full with ISIS, with worrying about military readiness, with worrying about an array of other threats that are also pressing and aren't just about reforming things, but are about keeping America safe today.
Yeah, and I think their posture is generally, Goldwater-Nichols is working pretty well, as opposed to 1982 when you had the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff saying, guys, the whole system is broken, please help us.
Right. And I think, part of one piece of this that I think I've tried to push back on a little bit is that I think just talking about it as Goldwater-Nichols reform, in some ways, I think doesn't capture where the real conversation is and has been over recent years. So acquisition reform, sometimes some people lump that under Goldwater-Nichols reform. I don't think that's particularly helpful because there's been so much work on acquisition reform for years. That's not something that's sort of sat silent for the last 30 years. There are pieces of this that I think are, larger than just Goldwater-Nichols, which was about, promotions and jointness and things like that. This is the questions that are being asked, which, again, I still don't think we've really refined them far enough, but the questions that are being asked are things like, roles and missions and, what is the relationship between the State Department, DOD, and the National Security Council? All of those things are important questions that take some time, but I also hesitate. I think perhaps the conversation would be better served if we could come up with a different category, a different label for this whole conversation.
Yeah, fair point. So we should mention just for listeners that the administration has threatened to veto this bill if it survives or passes in its current form. But you write that this could serve or should serve as the foundation for a successful and broader reform effort. How does that process work in your view, and in what ways does this bill become a foundation?
Yeah, well, I think first of all, the veto threat from the president and his team, I think there may be pieces of the Goldwater-Nichols reform debate that inform that, but I think it's also probably mostly driven by larger budget issues, Guantanamo Bay, prison, things like that. So I don't think, although there are pieces, particularly of Senator McCain's proposal, that senior DOD leaders oppose, some of the reorganization proposals, I think most of that can be worked out. But I think I think it's really a question of frame of mind. Are the senators and congressmen who are negotiating the final bill, and are the political leaders in the Pentagon, do they see this as a one-year fight where they're going to, all go back to the wall and fight their hardest for whatever provision they want to see? Or do they see this really as a baseline to start a conversation that continues into the next administration that really involves Congress, involves civilian and military leaders in the Pentagon, in having a thoughtful conversation about what's working, what's not working, how to make the Pentagon a better place and make the military more effective in the end? And I think rushing this in the last few months of the administration in an election year, the odds of producing a good product are pretty low. There's just too many other things going on. So I think instead of going that direction, I think viewing this, deliberately thinking about this bill as a starting point. So if there are controversial pieces, maybe it's better to say, all right, let's not do that this year. Let's think about this for next year. These problems are not going away overnight, and we're certainly not going to solve them overnight.
That's Justin Johnson. He's a senior analyst in defense budgeting policy at the Heritage Foundation, joining us to talk about the defense authorization bill that's working its way through conference committee right now. Justin wrote a recent report urging Congress to ease off on its attempts to reform DOD's organizational chart. We'll link to that at federalnewsradio.com/ondod. When we come back, we'll talk to the commander of what's now the largest cyber operations center in the United States. The commander of DISA Global Operations Command joins us. That's next on federalnewsradio.com. And 1500 AM. This is On DOD. I'm Jared Serbu. Welcome back to On DOD on federalnewsradio.com, 1500 AM in the Washington, D.C. area and worldwide on the American Forces Network. And we'll spend this segment on defensive cyber operations. Just about a month ago, the Defense Information Systems Agency cut the ribbon on the largest cyber operations center in the country at Scott Air Force Base in Illinois. The $100 million complex consolidates 950 employees working for DISA Global Operations Command, plus two cyber protection teams from the Air Force and Marine Corps. Colonel Paul Kraft is the commander of DISA Global. He talked with me about the 164,000-square-foot facility, the decision to build it in the St. Louis area, and what DISA Global does day in and day out. I don't usually ask people to brief their org charts, but I think some people have a hard time getting their heads around everything the department's doing with regard to cyber protection between CyberCom, the service components, Joint Force Headquarters Doden, DISA CONUS, now DISA Global. So maybe you can just start us off by talking about where your organization sits in that whole construct and what your specific mission set is.
Sure. So Lieutenant General Lynn is DISA's director, and also the commander of Joint Force Headquarters Department of Defense Information Networks. The establishment of his dual-hatted position creates a fusion between command and control and the authorities between U.S. Cyber Command, Joint Force Headquarters Doden, and the Defense Information Systems Agency. This relationship really inherently links the agency priorities and creates opportunities for synergy between initiatives and missions supporting all of cyberspace operations. Now, specifically for DISA Global Operations Command, we are the largest operational command within DISA itself, and we're the lead for operating and defending the enterprise infrastructure and services that make up the Defense Information Systems Network within the Department of Defense's Information Network. There are other field offices and other field commands that are aligned to each of the combatant commanders and subunified commanders located around the world. We DISA Global Operations Command, known as DISA Global, we are globally aligned, and we support each of those field offices and field commands and those combatant commands, services, and agencies that utilize the Department of Defense's network backbone, and receive enterprise services.
So help me understand how your cyber protection mission is distinct or complementary to the cyber protection teams that the services are building and now starting to operate.
So we have, there are four types of cyber protection teams. There's national teams, combatant command teams, teams known as Doden teams, and then service teams. There are six Doden teams, think of them as maybe DISA teams, that are aligned to DISA. And with of those six DISA-focused cyber protection teams that are OpCon to Cyber Command, and then OpCon further down to Joint Force Headquarters Doden, there are cyber protection teams that are then in direct support of DISA. Specifically, there are four teams in direct support of DISA Global. So we actually have two cyber protection teams that are from U.S. Cyber Command that are actually embedded with us in our operations here in Illinois, and then two that are embedded in DISA's headquarters out in Fort. So we actually have an Air Force team located in the building here, and we also have a Marine Corps team that's in the building here, and they bolster our cyber defenses and what we provide, what DISA provides, by providing an additional layer of security and defense and also intelligence with intelligence arm of each of these cyber protection teams that really solidifies and integrates defensive cyberspace operations for the Department of Defense.
Got it. Okay, so let's talk a bit about this new $100 million facility that you folks just cut the ribbon on a few weeks ago. Now that you've done this consolidation, does the workforce that you have there at Scott really comprise the bulk of what makes up DISA Global?
Yes. So I would say 70% of DISA Global is here in Illinois, along with those two cyber protection teams, roughly about 1,000 folks here at the main headquarters. But we also have, you get to call them battalions or squadrons that are located in Columbus, Ohio, in Springfield, Virginia, down in Montgomery, Alabama, Pensacola, Florida. We have other locations that have other capabilities within the command that are both operationally controlled or direct supported or assigned to DISA Global Operations Command. So, but the majority of our command is within this new facility.
Yeah. So talk a bit about what that brings to the table in terms of just consolidating so much of that global workforce into one physical location.
Sure. So the DISA Global, as I mentioned before, is the lead for operating and defending the infrastructure and services that make up the Department of Defense's information network. That includes some major capabilities like the internet access point, so DoD's access to the internet. We run that and defend that from here. The joint regional security stack is a very, very important cyber defensive capability within the Department of Defense. NIPRNet and SIPRNet are non-secure and secure internet protocols. Also voice and video services. Our mobility devices and also cloud gateways are operated and defended from here. We also have the mission here in this new facility of mission assurance to ensure that all the airborne intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance, remotely piloted aircraft circuits, global missile defense, nuclear command and control, and White House circuits are also supported. And that is the majority. That is roughly about 800 folks within the building. And then JFHQ Doden, again, has two embedded cyber protection teams. Cyber protection teams are about 39 personnel each that are also embedded onto our floor. So inside this facility, we're able to work with our specific customers in the defense of the network, also operations of the network, supporting combatant commands, defense agencies, federal agencies, and also the clear defense contractors.
Since you brought up JRSS, the department leadership has talked so extensively about JRSS in terms of, as the military services converge around those, just adding so much more capability to see down into service-specific and DoD agency-specific networks to be able to, you know, have that situational awareness so that you can operate and defend the network and monitor them from a facility like yours, I would imagine. How much is that JRSS convergence kind of baked into the go-forward plan for DISA Global?
It is. So JRSS is central to what we do here. So the Global Operations Center for JRSS is embedded into DISA Global here in Illinois. So not only do we run and defend JRSS from here around the world for all the JRSS stacks as they stand up, but we're also responsible with our joint migration teams to actually help our customers, like the Army that was here this week, of getting their post camps and stations onto JRSS system itself. So clearly we're an advocate for JRSS. It's a great system. The more folks realize the quality of service that you get out of it from a network perspective and from a defensive perspective, from a DCO perspective, more and more folks are going to want to use this system. It is a great defensive capability that's coming online right now.
So even though these are regional centers, they're still kind of centrally overseen from right there at Scott?
They are regional stacks, but everything is centrally managed from here, yes.
So talk about...
We actually operate and defend the stacks from here.
Talk about the future a little bit, if you would. The announcement that you folks put out a few weeks ago talked about the fact that beyond the 950 civilian and military and contract employees that have already come to Scott, there are some plans for future growth. So what's the plan ahead?
So the facility has the flexibility currently on how it's configured to allow for modifications as new missions emerge and our workforce grows to meet those needs of the warfighter. But in the near term, actually, DISA and the senior leaders of Illinois have been our advocates to expand on this building already, just based on what we know we already can do. This potential expansion would create additional opportunity for DISA to employ additional resources that are really vital to counter the emerging threats of our nation.
Are there any specific attributes about Scott and the general region around you that made this a logical place to put DISA Global, either in terms of just floor space or the local organic workforce? Why does Scott make sense for this?
Well, I'll say the Air Force has been a great partner of DISA, and Scott Air Force Base is a great location in the center of our country, right outside St. Louis, to have a great area for people to be hired. There is a major cyber capability here that the Air Force has. They have 15 cyber protection teams on this base also, along with the 688th Cyber Operations Group. There's the Air Force's NIC is also here. So there are major IT and cyber capabilities for the Air Force here. We've always been here. We've been here for more than 20 years as an agency, DISA has, and we just have continued to grow that capability here in the center of the country to provide that operation support globally at Scott Air Force Base.
I think you mentioned earlier that you're bringing in some Army reserve teams to work in the facility in addition to the CPTs that you've already got from Air Force and Marine Corps. Overall, what's the Guard and Reserve role in what you're trying to do there?
So we are integrating the Compo 3 Army Reserve and actually Air Force Reserve officers and NCOs into our real world current operations. The reserves, Army Reserves, have known as the Army Reserve element of DISA, are located in Colorado and in Alabama and in Missouri. And they come in and we are working through to get them trained to conduct both, I'll say, network operations, but also defensive cyberspace operations, because we have the ability to do training here and obviously a very large floor to conduct operations. So, and that's also for the Army Reserve element, the Air Force Reserve element that is here also. So it's been a major effort to get the reserves integrated into here, and we're continuing to work toward having them fully integrated to support us on both weekends and then major times throughout the year.
Hmm. And as I understand it, this facility sounds like it was basically purpose built to be a large cyber operations center. As you put together the plan for this facility, what were the sorts of creature comforts that you decided you needed to have specific to this mission?
So we have the well-being of our workforce has been the number one focus for what we do here, and is obviously people are the backbone for the missions that we support and the continuity for those missions going forward. So we do have not only the largest, I'll say, cyber operations center in the DoD, but we also have a 3,200 square foot wellness center here open to all DISA employees 24/7 on site in the facility. We also have an APES restaurant that's with healthy food options for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and it's also open on weekends. And then we have a world-class training facility and conference center and teaming rooms within this new facility that can bring us hands-on training on site, establishing also a communications university here through CECOM, Army CECOM, and also collaborating with organizations both inside and outside the DoD to include academia from St. Louis and in the Illinois region.
And finally, I guess one of my last questions would be, since cyber defense is not exclusively a DoD mission, especially when we're talking about protecting things besides strictly military networks, any connections you want to talk about with other elements of government outside of the DoD, like DHS or the NCIC or other civilian agencies?
So we do have obviously connections to other entities outside of the DoD, and we continue to strive to improve on our technologies and relationships when it comes to defensive cyberspace operations, because it certainly is a team sport. In that effort, we work closely with industry, and again, I've talked about academia, but also the federal agencies to improve collaboration and also defensive measures. As always, we'll continue to seek out and encourage new collaboration opportunities. Obviously, we have meetings with industry. Industry comes here, and we go see industry. And we're also prepared to collaborate with any of those other partners.
Colonel Paul Kraft is the commander of DISA Global Operations Command, speaking to us by phone from Scott Air Force Base. We'll post links to more information about DISA Global and the new operations center we've been talking about at federalnewsradio.com/ondod. Back in just a minute, and we'll hear from the creator of a life-saving technology that promises to curb one of the leading causes of battlefield deaths. That's next on federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. This is On DoD. I'm Jared Serbu. Thanks for listening to federalnewsradio.com and 1500 AM. This is On DoD. I'm Jared Serbu. For more than a decade, Army researchers have been looking for ways to better detect the number one cause of deaths from battlefield injuries, internal bleeding. That work has paid off in the form of a system called APPRAISE, which uses artificial intelligence to automatically alert medics that a patient is hemorrhaging and needs trauma care right away.
For our last few minutes of the show this week, we're going to talk to one of the creators of Appraise. Jack Reifman is a senior research scientist at the Army Medical Research and Materiel Command. He talked with me about the system and how it came to be.
What we have identified is that the majority of the casualties died at a point of injury, at the battlefield, before ever reaching a medical treatment facility. And also, when we look at those casualties and the ones that could have potentially survived, we determined that hemorrhage is the leading cause of preventable death.
And are these symptoms that are just not easily detectable by a trained medic with the naked eye, for lack of a better word?
Well, it's very hard sometimes to determine, you know, look at patterns or the vital signs of a subject and determine what is the near-term future. Is this person is going to actually currently having a life-threatening hemorrhage, or this person can just wait for many hours until evacuation later on. So it's really not obvious, looking at the vital signs, what the outcome is going to be. In particular, if we're talking about a medic that has, 10, 12 weeks of training, they're not really doctors, and they are working in a very difficult condition in the perhaps environment. Somebody may be shooting at you. So to make those diagnoses in real time under those very stressful conditions are not easy.
Right. And if you can make that diagnosis and gather all these vital signs in a meaningful way and detect that internal bleeding, what does it enable you to do? What interventions can you then take that can save a person's life?
Well, the many interventions one can make, but one of the key things that we had in mind was to determine the individuals who actually are in need for an immediate evacuation and those that can wait. And sometimes you can imagine that we're in the certain conditions where immediate evacuation could be risky. So we'd like to make that decision as well-informed, as educated as we possibly can.
How exactly did your interest in this problem get sparked, and what led you to the conclusion that artificial intelligence and what eventually became Appraise was a good solution?
Well, the reason that we became interested in this problem, because it is, again, the leading cause of preventable death of our service members. And we look at what it was that we could do. We know that vital signs measure vital signs are widely available throughout the echelon of care in the military. And we looked at then what could we do with vital signs. So what we have done is really mine large amount of casualty vital sign data, then to determine which vital signs would be most appropriate, most useful for distinguishing those casualties with life-threatening hemorrhage versus those that did not. And we use AI, artificial intelligence, to look for those patterns.
And what does an Appraise unit itself consist of? I mean, does it require its own specialized equipment to monitor vital signs? Or are you able to just plug in to systems that a medic would already be using in transport or on the battlefield?
Yeah, the latter, exactly. That's actually the greatest benefit of the Appraise, that we do not require new sensor modalities. The Appraise takes information from standard vital sign monitoring equipment that measures heart rate, respiratory rate, blood pressure. And the core of the Appraise is really a software system that looks at patterns in these vital signs and then determines which ones are associated with life-threatening hemorrhage versus those that are just transient changes in vital signs but do not not associated with life-threatening conditions.
So is it on like a mobile device, a tablet or a smartphone of some kind, and fairly easy to use for a medic who has, as you said, 10 to 12 weeks of training?
Absolutely. The initial implementation that we did at Boston MedFlight, which is civilian air ambulance that serves the Boston area hospitals, the Appraise system, the brains, the artificial intelligence, resided in a ruggedized PC that weighs about 2 pounds, and that's what attached to a monitor system that collects the vital signs. So that's all we take is a ruggedized PC, a tablet, or a smartphone that could process the information from the vital signs.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that partnership with Mass General up in the Boston area. Was it always obvious to you that this was going to have civilian applications, and how did they get involved in this project?
Yeah, the application here is really dual purpose. Obviously, in the military, as I said earlier, the majority of the deaths occur in the battlefield, due to bleeding. And also, when you look at the civilian population, the number one cause of death of otherwise healthy civilians is due to trauma if they're under age of 45. So once we determine that we're working on that project, we look for partners and met physicians from Mass General Hospital that were very interested in that kind of work, and then we established a relationship, and they help us in this very complex interdisciplinary problem, providing medical expertise.
And how has that worked out so far? What kind of accuracy rates are you seeing in that test environment?
Yeah, what we, again, have done at the Boston Med Flight, we deploy that, and we able to demonstrate that the ability to automatically identify hemorrhaging patients before arrival at the hospital, in general, within about 10 minutes of monitoring those patients, and we obtain sensitivity, that is, the ability to diagnose those life-threatening hemorrhage about 80% of the time.
And that civilian context is a little bit different, right? Because unlike in a battlefield situation, they're generally not waiting for transport anyway in most cases. So once hemorrhaging is identified in that kind of circumstance, what benefit does that give you? That you just know that they're going to need a transfusion as soon as they get to a medical facility?
Right. There are many benefits. If you talk about the urban environment, the system could be helpful in monitoring, providing another layer, if you will, of monitoring the system in alerting caregivers, or perhaps the blood pressure needs to be taken again. Let's make sure that the patient is not too cold, because it can lead to adverse events. But also can envision the benefit of appraise in a more rural setting, where specialized trauma centers may be hours away from the point of injury. And systems like that could help in triaging, determining should we, again, evacuate or bring this subject to a trauma center, or can we take care of the patient locally.
That's Jacques Reifman, a senior research scientist at the Army Medical Research and Materiel Command. And by the way, he and his team are finalists in this year's Service to America medals for their work on appraise. Earlier in the hour, we heard from Colonel Paul Kraft, the commander of DISA Global Operations Command, about the stand-up of what's now the biggest cyber operations center in the U.S., and the Heritage Foundation's Justin Johnson urging Congress to take a breath before it moves ahead with another reorganization of the Pentagon. If you missed those conversations, we'll post this week's entire program at federalnewsradio.com/ondod. That's going to do it for this week's program. Thanks, as always, for tuning in. I'm Jared Serbu. So long.
You've been listening to On DoD with Federal News Radio DoD reporter Jared Serbu. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. On DoD, only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.